We were struggling a little bit in our London studio, and this idea of this big job was like, great. We went against our values, and that's something we hadn't done before and we won't do again. We knew we were taking a risk and we knew it could bite us because definitely values were not aligned, and it was the worst fit. And where I am the most sad about it was that it damaged a lot of the people that worked in it. It was a perfect example of what not to do.
How do some of the world's sharpest minds start their day? By putting their brain first. And it's not just our secret leaders who kick off every day with heights. From Stephen Fry to best-selling author and fellow podcaster Dr. Rangan Chatterjee, who give us rave reviews. So if you care about your brain's health and cognitive potential, think heights. Listeners can get 25% off their first month with the code LEADERSHEIGHTS at www.yourheights.com. Our guest this morning is on the more unconventional side. I mean, for starters, he wouldn't necessarily like to call himself a leader, but what better setup for a secret leader than that? Matt Miller, aka Mills to his friends and to everyone else, aka the Chief Wonka, is a co-founder of the Fampany, Reed family company, Us Too, the design studio that occupies the ground floor of the Tea Building in Shoreditch, famous for hosting many of the UK's most creative brands, including Shoreditch House. Mills started his career at the design studio Animal, and by the sounds of it, his first and only ever boss demonstrated to him just how leadership could be. A friendship based on trust and shared values, and that's something that he and co-founder John Sinclair, aka Sinks, learned from, and brought with them to Us Too from the day they started it, and will carry it through to the day they never, ever sell it. Today's discussion on superb leadership won't cover some of the previous glitz and glam moments of selling and buying Lambos, but instead about putting values and culture at the heart of an organisation that really seems to be more about lifestyle design in action, keeping your creativity in full flow, full-time employed with no intention to sell to anyone, just to create the best working environment imaginable. Most recently, Mills has stepped back from the day-to-day running of Us Two Studios and is focused now more on the adventure side of the business, their venture arm, which includes some well-known brands such as Marvel, the prototyping app, that is, rather than Spider-Man, and Dice, the events app, again, not the six-sided gaming tool, he's not that old. So enough about talking about him, let's crack on and just talk to him. It's our secret leader du jour, Mr. Matt Mills of Us Two. So, Matt, welcome to the show, dude.
Thank you very much.
Welcome, Mills, I should say. Who calls you Matt? Your mum.
That was, if I was going to change anything about that intro, it would have been never reveal the name, but you've revealed it, and I'm happy for that. No one calls. Actually, you know, I find myself only ever introducing myself as Matt in certain situations, none of which I can remember now, but I feel, well, I have to be sensible, I need to say Matt. But I don't know what the need to have a full name is, why that makes me any better, or why. For me, having a full name is like wearing a suit. It's not me, so I'm honoured that I've been asked to come and speak.
Well, we're honoured to have you.
In this secret chamber.
There you go. 2018 is your year, as you said, about doing new things.
It is.
And you don't really do interviews traditionally too much, do you?
No.
So what new things are you doing in 2018? Take us through it. This podcast is one new thing.
So this year, I've set myself a goal of running my first 100-mile ultramarathon. And 6 months ago, actually, as a precursor to getting into a position to do that, stopped drinking alcohol, became a vegetarian, moved near as I could get to veganism, and started just treating myself, my body, right. I realised I'd probably spent 14 years so obsessed with the one thing I loved at the time, really, which was Us Two. Other than my family. And I turned on its head and I said, actually, none of that mattered. Actually, what mattered is that I actually walked every day. I moved and I walked. I actually felt good about myself. And it's been a game changer. And so especially the last 2 weeks, I've pushed myself to spend every morning from about 5:30 to about 8:30 stretching, meditating, and just spending time on my own. And it kind of is still, it's not hard. It feels a bit cringy talking about it like that, but it actually does make a genuine difference to me. And just so this year I've also got rid of my phone in terms of actually using it as like a constant,
tracker.
Exactly. I just don't, something that was just, I kept having these flashbacks of last year being in multiple meetings. I'm sure you've been in those where actually no one really is present. They're on their computers, they're talking on Slack, they're talking on WhatsApp. And, you know, actually, I was a big proponent of using WhatsApp within the studios and make sure that anyone could contact me any time of the day. But that's bad. I've realised it's really bad. So, Yeah, so I'm just I'm concentrating on myself. I'm being really selfish. I'm going on huge runs, and I'm loving it. I'm absolutely loving it. I mean, I'd love to believe I set my coach that I hired the challenge of like getting me, you know, to be as close as a almost 40-year-old pro can be.
Nice. So, I mean, if this is your first ever podcast, we should probably break you in gently.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll be nice and calm. What's the most terrifying thing you've ever done in your journey of us two?
I often talk about what me and Sinks do, because we built a company that was so much, you know, obviously called Us Two.
Yeah.
In some ways, I think one of the most terrifying things has been the decision end of last year for Sinks and myself to go our separate ways within the business. So Sinks is now focusing exclusively on studios in terms of the client service side of the business. And I am focusing on the kind of the startup in some ways, the adventure side. And I think that's probably not the most terrifying thing. But the terrifying thing is, like, we spent 14 years believing that we're better 100% always as one. And I think actually what we learned is that we didn't develop as much as we need to as leaders, because we were always relying on the other one to top each other off. And by forcing ourselves apart, we're actually finding that we're actually strong. We are becoming stronger, better leaders without the crux of the other. Terrifying thing has also definitely been we elevated like the need, the use of values a few years ago as the company got like 300 people. The utility of values became obvious. And, you know, rather than just having values written all over the wall, we really understood that you need to use those values in your everyday. So you have to actually hire and fire with that. And when we looked at across the company, there were definitely some people that we had to help to move on. It was difficult because a lot of those people were our friends. But actually, you know, we were doing them a disservice as well by sort of not developing our company and bringing the right people with us. So
are you kind of talking about, you know, deciding what the different aspects of how Us Two looks in 10 years, 50 years, 100 years, deciding on them at this point in the journey and saying, I don't care if you're the biggest biller and every single person in the company loves you for these three things, you're missing the fourth value and we can't develop it with you, so you have to go? It's that kind of thing. It's been that brutal.
There's definitely times where, yeah, we've had to be like that. I think equally, you know, the good thing is that while having to do that, and I imagine many businesses go through this, we've also understood how to hire people. Don't hire people that don't have those values or aren't interested in modeling those values in the first place. And of course, the early years, you know, when you're hacking stuff together, as you know too well, when you're younger as well, I wasn't really aware of the utility of those values. I was just displaying those values every day. Yeah, I mean, I think we're never looking like 10 years ahead. I think it's impossible to gaze that far ahead. We definitely have looked back in Us Two's history and seen that every two or three years the company has had to change because in order to stay relevant in the industry. You know, I remember looking back a few years back with Sinks and saying, fuck, we are actually, Us Two is not a young nipple on the street anymore. It's actually that was going on 12 years. And that's, I started to get a little bit worried that, you know, we could become one of those legacy companies that I see in the industry that sold out quite early or late in the game. And I think it's just a shell of the company it was. It doesn't have that rigor and that excitement. Like, I also went through a stage a few years ago. I mean, I've spent, you know, 2 years, maybe 3 years constantly going back and forth whether or not I'm still right to be in Us Two, whether Us Two is right for me. Because I didn't have anything other than Us Two, which is why I talked at the beginning about wanting to be selfish now. Finding something outside of Us Two that isn't, that can be a crux for me if Us Two's, you know, hurting me or something like that.
Mm. Okay. That was, that's, you know, how we ease you in gently, right?
With that's a really some random tidbits here and there.
No, with some, you know, deep info. So this is how we typically start our show. We just wanted to mess with you a little bit, knowing that it was your first time.
Yeah.
We do a quickfire round. Because
okay,
that actually eases people in. But, you know, you look suitably, comfortable perched on the corner of your seat there. Yeah, you do. Yeah. He's wearing his trademark shorts, just so everyone knows, and beanie.
And we are in January, just to give people the picture. It's cold outside, it's January, and Mills is wearing shorts.
Yeah, you know what? I've always worn shorts, I always find it. If you wear shorts, certainly when it's cold, it's, you know, people, it blows people's minds.
It's a really simple thing, isn't it?
It's a simple thing that blows, and I don't do it to blow their minds, but the amount of people that come up to me in coffee shops and sort of, A, they remind me that I'm wearing shorts as if I didn't know I was wearing them, and B, they question, like, aren't I cold? For me, it's just a symbolism of, like, giving so much of a shit that I don't give a shit. It's like, I'm just going to be me. It's like, I got invited to something at Downing Street in a few months, and I straight away wrote back and said, I'm not going to turn up in anything but shorts and T-shirt. If I need to turn up in something else that doesn't reflect who I am, I don't give a slice of shit. I'm not going to turn up. And that's why I said that's something I did recently. Also, I decided to stop doing anything that I didn't want to do anymore. If I need to do things that are going to help someone else, of course I'll do that. But I'm never, ever going to wear nothing but shorts. So I don't have any trousers.
Okay. So let's start with a quick fire round.
Oh, yeah, let's do it.
All right. Shorts or Y fronts?
Shorts.
Okay, just
checking. Shorts or what? Or as if he's going to go walking around town in Y fronts.
I want to see how extreme this guy's going to go.
Funny you should say that. I started Bikram yoga on last Friday, and I really loved that. And what I loved the most, I didn't really know what I was meant to do in Bikram. Like, what I knew it was going to be very hot, and I've heard you sweat, but I didn't know what attire I should really wear. So I went in with T-shirt and shorts. But the instructor came in with white, tiny little Y fronts. They were quite cute. And I thought, fucking hell, what a legend. So when I go in this Friday, I'm not wearing the shorts. I'm just going with the Y-Fi.
There you go.
So
now we know.
And I hadn't told you that before.
It does say shorts and trousers. You just winged that, didn't you?
I just changed it. Yeah, exactly.
This guy's good, though.
Listen, I wrote the interview. I could fucking change it on the fly if I want to. Us two or us three or us four? As in, you're going to add partners to it and keep growing that way?
No, there are two other partners in us too, you know, minority shareholders. But we've never used that as a kind of... It was a gesture of many years back of kind of thanks to two people who went a long way with the company. So no, in fact, 100% no. Why I'll never sell the business and we'll never add partners.
Okay. London or New York?
London.
Design or development?
I should say both because I run a company with both, but
of course,
I'm a designer.
That's the whole point. Oh, you're a designer. Okay. Favorite leadership book you've ever read?
That's always the one I knew was going to come, the book one. I don't read many books.
There can be I'm Illiterate. We can just use that.
Well, you know what? I haven't read enough interesting books that will actually give anyone any value. What I do know is that I haven't read enough in my life. The other day I realised that when you learn. It's something quite new to me. So I've started to learn now.
Okay.
Do you listen to audiobooks?
I do listen to audiobooks.
What's your favourite audiobook?
That's kind of what I was assuming. I only do audiobooks
I said yes with conviction there because I'm listening to my first one right now.
And what are you listening to?
Mindful Running.
Okay.
So The Art of Running Mindfully.
What's the best app you've ever used?
You should have sent me these bloody questions before.
Yeah, you can think.
Well, I will say Spotify. It's such a standard one, so we'll get
it.
No,
it's fair, but I mean, as in like, whatever your answer is, that is absolutely Spotify my number one favorite app.
I actually really like my Notes app as well. I'm trying to understand how better to use, you know, my phone, and I just like to dump stuff down there. I've tried loads of other apps that are kind of meant for that, but they're like graveyard apps. You put them in, then you never look at them again. But I mean, you can't not love Twitter. Ironically, I haven't used it for 2 weeks, but...
Are you iPhone or Android?
100% iPhone.
Okay. And what's the app you're using most on your phone right now, other than Notes?
Strava.
Yeah, okay.
Strava. I've only started using it since I got into running 6 months ago, and actually, I'm starting to see that being my new community.
Just going to sense check how honest you're going to be for the rest of the interview.
Very honest.
What's the worst product you've ever made?
I still love it, but there's an app we make called Honk, which is like pre-Snapchat. And I always like to believe we made like... Well, I don't like to believe... it was the shittest thing ever. I mean, leading up to Monument Valley, I went on this tour, like, you know, for 3-4 years talking with... on stage about, you know, our failures, our successful failures. And they were like 16, you know, pretty bad things when I look back at them. But I think Honk was dreadful because it was an app that absolutely no one needed or wanted. And it was proved by the fact that even though it's free, no one downloaded it. It was like a messaging app.
Sure.
But it had heart, but it was dreadful.
And is that the worst idea you've ever had?
Sinks hates it. I still think it had legs.
All right, so what's the worst idea, do you think?
The worst idea? Well, that never actually became something.
Or maybe it did become something that's even worse than Honk as an idea.
Well, honestly speaking, we made this thing called Papa Quash. And it was actually
already sounds like the worst idea.
It wasn't my idea. This was in my height of stupidity. I've never talked about this actually. In my height of sort of loving people, there was a famous Big Brother kid called Sam Pepper, and I liked the guy. And we looked after him for many years, and he had this idea for this app, and we made it for him just on the side. You know, it wasn't like a paid job, but it turned out to be a pretty much copy of a PlayStation game. And I remember still waking up. It was horrifying, actually, I have to be honest. It made me really... I went off Twitter for over a year, and I felt like leaving the industry because I woke up one morning, I still remember it now, lying in bed, and I'm looking at Twitter, and of course we launched it the night before, so excited for him. He had a big following. God, could this be the first thing we've made that actually people use? This was my side of the business, and I started reading people that I really respected sort of questioning the integrity of us two and me. And I was like, what's going on here? And then the more I looked into it, it suddenly dropped to me that, you know, the idea wasn't necessary. Looking back now, it was fucking madness that it was ever really, it was compared. But, you know, I saw an entire swarm of people on Twitter turn on me, and I didn't know how to deal with it at all. It was bad. It was horrible, actually. It was a low point of my life, without a shadow of a doubt. And it stopped me doing talks. My confidence went. I just went up. I remember I went up to Shortridge House with Steve, who's led sort of marketing PR for many years, us two, and just sat there. I just didn't know what to do. I couldn't face it. I felt like I dishonoured everyone, so I had to own up. Well, obviously, I spoke to everyone at Us2 because everyone at Us2 starting to say, why is Us2's names getting smashed about in the press?
What had you done that was so wrong? Or was it just fairly trivial? You were supporting a Big Brother person.
It was, in Ireland, what happened is, when I look back now, what he had done is he had reached out to this guy down in Australia who had made a famous PlayStation game, which is to do with accelerometer and this device, and said, would you mind if he made his version of it, which is, you know, And the guy said, no problem. The problem is that when Sam actually releases it, he said that Us2 helped him. And this guy down in Australia rightfully goes, wait a sec, that's a big corporate. It's a corporate that done it. Sam tricked me. They're going to make loads of money. And it wasn't like that at all. It was a side project that I did. We reached out to him and we spoke to him, and he understood eventually, but not before. Every journalist who had probably, you know, it's funny, you introduced me as Chief Walker. I haven't heard that for many years. And I think that was at the time, you know, I was the guy that was often in the small, tiny community I was in, wearing this fucking pink wig, maybe being a fucking idiot. You know, for some journalists, perfect, we'll turn this guy now. And I understand why they do it.
So, in the story of Mills, you're obviously the author of your own story, but I've taken the trouble of crafting some chapters for you.
Brilliant.
So, we're going to start at chapter one, as you do. This is the story of Mills before Us2. Tell us who you were. Tell us about the chap that grew up in Tunbridge Wells and getting himself into Brighton College of Technology.
Well, I think I was, you know, looking back now, I was always a fairly popular guy, but what I liked about that was... That was obviously because I was just a nice person, always semi-funny, because actually I was the guy that wore Burton's trousers at the time. That's probably why I wear shorts now. You know, like the worst clothes you've ever wear. And my haircuts were always styled on like the boy band at the time. So I had the Peter Andre, I had the Ronan Keating, I had the Justin Timberlake when he shaved it off. So I mapped back my hair, and then it all fell out. And that's why I wear a beanie now. So I didn't have any idea really. I don't know why I said that, because I had every idea that I wanted to be in design. I have a family that have got tradition in design, so I was lucky enough to understand the power of design. And Brighton was a great college to go to, because Brighton was definitely a cooler town than Tunbridge Wells, which is where me and Sinks grew up. You know, it's a fairly eclectic place, although I didn't really like it. Sinks loved it because it was all about ideas, and then he went to St. Martin's because he was so cool. And
So he didn't go to Brighton with you?
No, he went to Brighton. We drove down every day, and then St. Martin's came down one day. He'll love this. St. Martin's come down to sort of headhunt, you know, the best students from Brighton, because Brighton's cool. So Sinks gets in, and I had my interview, and I didn't get in. I wouldn't have got my own. I didn't have a fucking clue what I was doing.
Let's move on to chapter two then, which is your first job. Yes. So what was it like? What did you learn? Tell us about that experience and how it helped form you as a then company founder afterwards.
So, you know, Sinks and myself, best mates since 11. He goes to St. Martin's. You know, it took me 3 years to get over the fact that he got in, I didn't. But, you know, he came back to my saviour 3 years later, where the beauty of being in London, of course, was while he was at St. Martin's, the one benefit I see is that you're sort of in London, and he got to do a lot of work experience with great companies. And while he was at one of them, I think Fitch, he meets Dom Del Torto, and he sort of puts together this company called Big Animal, which isn't very big. It's him, in fact, and Matt Ellingson. And they are two of the most, I mean, they're brilliant guys they're magic. But they built a design company, but they weren't really designers as such. Dom definitely more so, he's more of an animator. Anyway, so they need designers. So Sinks phones me up one day and says, I've got this potential job, but they're interested in hiring both of us. I'm like, wow, that sounds perfect. So I had to make a decision between going to the team, which was actually a really established big design company with a lot of credibility, or going to this actual genuine startup. and I got that job. I went with that in the end because I felt like, A, my best mate was there, and B, I felt I just loved the two guys that ran it. So over those 3 or 4 years, you know, what I learned there is that my dreams come true in that there are places out there that you can just be yourself. Dom is, you know, amazingly bonkers, and you know, me and Sinks, I think, you know, worked extremely hard there, but we also partied extremely hard, and don't, over in Brick Lane, so like our East London world, life begins. And yeah, I just learned that, you know, you just need to know, you need to be friends with your clients, and you need to party with them, and you need to, but most of all, you need to deliver always for them. And we loved it. 4 years working with Sony over in Tokyo most of the time. And it was brilliant. I loved it.
And you're still friends with the guy?
Still friends with the guy. Yeah, I don't see him that much anymore. Matt Allison's actually down in New Zealand. But, you know, that gave us the grounding to believe that you can create this kind of micro-utopia that is just like 24-hour party people. And I don't mean just drinking all the time. I just mean we were there all the time. And it was, it didn't feel like work. Well, actually, ironically, we probably didn't do that much work, which is probably why I eventually left. But it gave us the confidence to believe that. Well, actually, it gave us the time, because I leave Bath, digital is just really emerging properly. And over those 4 years, we honed our craft around doing sort of interactive design. So we were doing quite boring work for like Sony, like menu systems, but we were honing this understanding of user experience. And then by the time Sony Ericsson get born, we thought, right, now's the time to big M. I think we've had our time here. We'll start something new. Our clients wanted to work with me in Sinks. Sony Ericsson bring out this new phone. Flashlight becomes the way to make their interfaces much better than the Nokia's, and they want me and Sinks to do it. So they, the only bit of business we ever did was they hired me and Sinks for a whole year. I think it was £12,500 contract. So we just used that money to hire the two other guys that we met at Big Animal as well, Marcus, who's one of the other partners, and Gypsy, and they came over straight away. And
so that's the story of how us two began.
That's how it began, yeah. And yeah, I mean,
so taking us into then chapter three, which is the start of us two, which in itself could be its own novel. We'll see where this goes. So you've just sort of explained where the momentum came from at the very least. But what about the idea? Was there an idea? Was there a purpose? Was there a sense of mission? Or was it more you wanted to be your own boss and you'd learned enough from that point just to do it?
Yeah, we often reflect on that. There's definitely no sort of we want to be our own boss. Like, that wasn't really of interest to us. We definitely knew, though, that, you know, there was the type of work we wanted to do was different to Big Animal. You know, we were really excited by interaction design. We were really excited by mobile, and you know, we saw an opportunity to go with that. And I think at the same time, though, where Sinks was definitely more of the hands-on like work person, I was definitely more interested in the sort of community side, the culture side. You know, together we love both, but you know, we wanted to create a space where we thought, you know, our rules lived, and those rules were often, they weren't really rules, it was just, you know, being, well, when we first started, it was like, you know, no, just be human, know our souls type. I can't even remember what it was, but it was quite standard stuff. And you know, we didn't have much money. We took £5,000 from my dad. He often always says he wished he hadn't asked for the money back, because you know, then he would own, you know, a big percentage, I guess, of us two, which I'm proud to say is probably one of the biggest, if not the biggest, privately owned, you know, product company. So into the client service product companies. I've digressed. Yeah,
Well, not really digressed, because that's part of the start of us too. You never took external funding, just that original £12,500 from Sony, right?
Yeah, it's a combination of £12,500 from Sony, and it was my dad's £5,000, which just gave us the money to buy two laptops. I'm looking at your laptop now. But, you know, we didn't want external money. We never have wanted that. We just wanted to build. I don't actually remember there being any other belief. There wasn't. I don't remember the startup scene. I mean, obviously, there will have been one, but there was no obsession about that. You know, it was just, we're going to build a business. We have to make money in order to pay the people that work here, including ourselves. And we're going to use that money to do things we want to do. Originally, it was like, we're going to buy lots of beer. And that kind of embarrassed me in some way, looking back now, because I don't think that's the way you build business now. But, you know, we couldn't beat the other big client service businesses in terms of money, because we didn't have any. But we felt like what's missing in those companies, when we looked around, they were all owned by big holding companies. We had experience of, we estimated what it must be like to work in one of those places. you know, we wanted to give people a sense. If you joined us too, you were going to get to know me and Sync really well. We're going to be building a business. You can observe as we're doing it. We're going to, transparency is standard. You know, it's now it's obviously like a big thing, but it was like, why would you not build a business on transparency? And that was what we always did. And you know, going to the pub every night and just, we consciously blurred the line between work and life. Like it wasn't, no, we weren't trying to say, go, we in those days, we definitely didn't say go home now and go and see your families. It was like, well, no, there's not going to be a work and a life because it's going to be one thing. Mm. And, you know, I would say for 8 years that it stayed like that, you know, as then eventually we understood the need to probably have that separation. But, you know, it was a great time.
Well, who were your first clients? You mentioned Sony. What about after that? What about the first 2 years? Take us through the first 2 years of us two.
So for the first 2 years, yeah, Sony Ericsson. You know, obviously mobile phones are becoming huge then, really popular. This is pre-iPhone here. And,
so yeah, we can directly track their demise down to you building their products, right?
It's definitely, yeah. I mean, yeah, I hope it's not, but yeah, I mean, there's definitely an association there.
Yeah, and then you did Nokia.
Yeah, you know, so funny enough, our first, the issue with Sony Ericsson was we weren't really allowed to associate with the work. And that's the problem with many client service agencies where you do great work, but you're not really allowed to talk about it. So although we had this amazing contract with them, and by year two or three, they were probably hiring 30 or 40 of us. You know, we really scaled quite quickly. That's over 3 years, that's 10 a year, it's not that quick. But we eventually get a job to do a painter and decorator's website. So we do that one just because we could. It was money and it wasn't Sony Ericsson. But, you know, by chance, the guy happens to be best mates with one of the bosses at Credit Suisse. And because of that network, we started to get we get a huge job for Credit Suisse building out there. One of their, Sinks says this a bit better than me because he actually did it and he knows what the fuck he's talking about, whereas I don't. So it's their foreign, I don't know, something to do with trading. Anyway, so Sinks, FX trading, exactly. Yeah. And so Sinks and the more intelligent members of us to sort of go off and do a huge project with that, with Credit Suisse. And I think at that stage, we start to really understand, okay, us two at that stage isn't known at all. But to anyone that does know us, we're quite a quirky company doing like really sort of abstract, sort of future-facing interfaces that ultimately leads to the demise. And you know, if you go into it, it's a quirky place. But actually, they're also working for Credit Suisse. So there's this balance there where you can work for Credit Suisse and you can still be like yourself. And I think all too often, my personal view was that too many companies, certainly in the user experience space, were kind of painting or were this like white-walled, like serenity, everything is like highly intelligent or certainly putting that off. And I didn't want to be like that. I wanted us to be a place where you're just being yourself. You don't have to be crazy, but you're just being yourself. And if that meant, you know, writing on the walls, then that's fine. If that meant wearing shorts, that's fine.
If that meant crazy hair,
if that meant crazy, I didn't have any by then.
Well,
I lost
no
it.
Hair then. That's also fine.
I had the wigs.
One of our generous sponsors is Contour, which is a new company focused on finding office spaces for startups, whether it's 4 or 6 desks, and taking you through to fit outs of offices as you scale up to hundreds. And we recently become a client myself as we scale. So what was your first office? How did you make the move into the T building? Essentially, we want, you know, chapter 4 for this big office move and growth moment.
We have to spend lots of money.
Yeah, I know that much.
Yeah, so we grow organically, and that's the way, you know, we want to build longevity. Us two is a place that we're never going to sell, and, you know, we want to be around for forever, you know, well beyond, you know, we hope us two's going well beyond Sinks and myself. So, you know, we believe it takes time. So we're quite steady in our growth. We were on Curtin Road, then we moved to Bateman's Road, which is just around the corner from the T building, where we take a fairly big space. We then take next door space. We then go upstairs as well. So it's very higgledy-piggledy. It doesn't work at all in terms of you have to actually go outside of one building and go down the street and get into the other. So eventually we decide to move to the T building. And it's too big. Without a shadow of a doubt, it's 2 floors in the T building. It's a lot of money. But it kind of, we feel like when we went and saw it, it's like, wow, this, you know, this, we can grow into this thing if we can afford it. So we take it. And I think that just gave us belief and also meant we had to actually work really hard because we had to pay the bills. But I think probably year three, we then opened Malmo. So because of our...
That was your second office.
That was our second office because our studio, I never called it an office, although I called it there one then. So Marcus then spent like 10 years here. He's Swedish, but he spent 10 years in the UK, and then he thinks it's time to go back to Sweden. And, you know, it just so happens, or probably the reason he did it, that Sony are based in Sweden, in Lund. So Malmo is the third biggest city, and that's just next to Lund. So we moved there and we opened there. And, you know, Marcus takes a lot of the values and the way he's learned through working with me and Sinks for by then 6 years, because he was a big animal as well. And he does a great job of kicking that one off as well. So it's step by step. We never planned anything. I'm really proud of I've never been strategic. I'm only now getting my head around this sort of, you know, the necessity for strategy, really, because we were wonderfully clueless in that we weren't trying to be anything we weren't. We weren't trying to achieve anything. We weren't just trying to survive, but we were just every day we were learning more and we were going with that. And it was just, I had this JFDI attitude. We were just trying things. If it felt good, we'd try it. If it failed, we didn't care. We'd tell people about it. And I think what we definitely started to realize is that clients just, you know, liked us as people. Like there's lots of jokers out there in the world, and we weren't trying to sell to our clients. We were being real. And being real is, you know, is a big value of ours.
Okay, so chapter 5, international expansion. You've just touched on Malmo. Where are your offices abroad? What order they go in? So we know that it was Malmo first. And actually, for a fun fact, I don't know if I've told you this before, but I've been to your New York office on Wall Street, played Mario Kart in what was described to me as the Mario Kart room. And it's absolutely incredible. So what do you prefer, that one or London? And take us through your expansion journey.
Yeah, so obviously we start London, we start Malmo, then we New York, and then Sydney is the latest one. And now we have two satellite studios in LA and Tokyo. I think that's out of a necessity, and a bit more strategic actually, in that New York especially, we did it the only way, you know, which is definitely going with big money. Take some nice space. You know, you've been to one of the studios. I don't know if you've been to the latest one.
Not on Wall Street then?
Yeah, so that's the one. Yeah,
that was amazing.
That's the second one, yeah.
It's incredible.
But, you know, it definitely cost a lot to kind of suddenly try to make a name for ourselves in New York. And I would say that 3 years, 4 years later, in fact, probably five actually, you know, it's still difficult to elevate yourself in that place. Manhattan is, I mean, you know, it's so crazy there. I think that's why I prefer London. I feel there's a sense of, like, you can know where us two is. I know we're in an iconic building, but, you know, it's not that busy. And I find Manhattan just so crazy. But America is somewhere, Sinks and myself, although we didn't want to go over there and do it, we understood the need to be in America. America is definitely a market where the next few years we're going to be really investing into. And then Sydney was the one that started 2 years ago. And that's been a really interesting journey. I mean, not least, obviously, it's hard to communicate there, and you've got to make a lot of effort there. And Joel, who leads that down there, makes an awful lot of effort to stay connected with us up here. But the magical thing there especially was that was the time where I really understood that us two is a special place in terms of our culture, because that studio, we didn't visit Sinks Myself for 2 years. And that sounds a bit odd, but it's a long way. And actually, you know, we were dealing with so much back in London and in terms of the whole of the us2 empire. And when we did visit it, there was about 15 people there. And, you know, we spent a week there, and we were able, because it's 15 people, we were able to spend, you know, one-on-ones with everyone there. And it really felt like a genuine family. Like, it was really hacky. It was in a much smaller studio than the ones we were used to in the bigger studios. And I just remember saying to Sinks, it was, wow, this is a proud moment. I just felt so connected to it and to everyone there, even though we had never met, you know, I'd say 70% of the people there. A lot of people had left from other studios. We knew them and gone and set it up. But yeah, it's magical. But I think, you know, now going forward, we intend to open new studios. That's the plan, because we want to be, the idea for me to have a studio is to be able to connect with that location and to bring our culture and our ethics to that town, and hopefully make an impact with in those cities, and also to discover as well. Like, I've spent too long just actually spending just in London. I want to be able to have a reason to visit, like, amazing places.
Well, where's next on your list? Where are you looking at?
Well, as I'm sure we'll talk later, I'm less in control of where we go now, as we're bringing in some incredible people to lead the studio side. I have West Coast is somewhere we're in LA right now, but we really want to make a go of West Coast properly. And also Austin is a place that we're seeing is a great place where we can grow well there. But I think, I don't know, rest of the world, Asia's fascinating. We're in Tokyo at the moment. Places I've never been before. I think if I've never heard anyone sort of conquer China yet in terms of and actually make a real proper genuine go of it. And in terms, so I would love to believe that one day we could.
Going to see you in Uzbekistan soon then. In new places no one's actually conquered yet in the design space.
Yeah, if I knew where that was, I'd go. Where that was, I'd go there. But
Central America, mate.
Oh, really?
No.
I was going to say, like, I definitely didn't know where it was then.
Okay, so just before we move on to the next chapter, just to round off your history of client servicing.
Yes.
Who's the worst client you've ever had?
I don't know if I'm allowed to say, really.
Well, just go for it. What's the worst that can happen? Are they still a client?
Well, no. The worst, without a shadow of a doubt, is a company called Power. And they were... It was an embarrassment. It was a perfect example of what not to do. I remember, you know, I backed the decision to do it, not prior to knowing anything about the guy and the company itself, to take on this big startup. Because... We know at the time, I think, you know, we were struggling a little bit in our London studio, and this idea of this big job was like, great. The problem is when we deep down looked at it and we went against our values, and that's something we hadn't done before and we won't do again. So we knew we were taking a risk and we knew it could bite us because it definitely values were not aligned, and it was the worst fit. And where I am the most sad about it was that it damaged a lot of the people that worked on it from us to perspective. You know, people who love us too so much put so much in to try to save that project, and it was a total waste of time. It was an awful, awful...
Did they go bust before you got to launch it?
They were... Oh, I don't think this thing was ever going to launch. I mean, it was terrible. I mean, they owed us £1 million. They owed us, everyone else, you know, shitloads of money as well. But it was... People like that shouldn't be allowed to run business. I don't understand it. It was a real low point in London, in us two. We really regretted doing it. It was such a waste of human capital. It was awful. But I think also, you know, that I don't think there are necessarily worse clients as such. I think client service is difficult, but it's actually no more difficult than working for some crazy loon founder. Or, you know, people are difficult. And, you know, more often than not, you're working with clients or founders who don't really understand what it is they're building. And, you know, maybe we don't 100% exactly understand because it's a new technology and we're all working together. And I think the problem is when you shoehorn a load of different people together, don't know each other, you know, it's going to be difficult. So that's why, you know, us two, we spend an awful lot of our time with coaches, making sure that we have team dynamics set up right between the client and ourselves. And we purposely discuss partnerships as opposed to clients, because I think we're trying to be one. Like, the best work is going to come when you're one team. Mm. Not when you're sort of, it's never like, hey, us to deliver this, make this and bugger off. Like, we are often in their studios or they're in our studios. And, you know, the idea is that we're teaching them to be able to take this product beyond our first iteration. And hopefully it lives forever. We're never building a product that just, that's it. It's not a campaign website. You know, it's actually some genuine utility.
Hey guys, this is Luke here, co-founder of Contour Space. Sorry to interrupt this awesome podcast, but I just wanted to tell you a bit more about us. We're a startup ourselves, helping awesome companies find amazing office spaces from start to finish, whether you're looking for a couple of desks to your next big HQ. We take care of the whole process from start to finish, and our service is completely free. Check us out on contour.space.
So moving on to the consumer space, which is chapter 6 in your story, you'll be pleased to know. Moving along.
That's MySpace. Not as in MySpace. MySpace.
I'm confused now.
Well, it's MySpace of the business.
I got you. I thought you were trying to make like a MySpace pun. Yeah, okay, cool. So moving on to chapter 6. Yeah, it didn't. Did it? No. Well, we'll find out. You've launched an absolute global smash hit game, Monument Valley, with a modest 40 million downloads. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it's a lot more now, but I can't remember. But it's done well for us.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about how you build a game that good and what the tricks you actually pulled off to grow to that number are, because that isn't just all magic. So, and this is your area. So give us a crash course in building a fucking global smash hit.
Okay, well, first of all, you know, unfortunately, it is the classic story of, like, you try many things before. And I think, so my successful failure journey that led to it, it's worth noting that sort of, whenever the iPhone comes out, I think it's 2008, I think it's 9 years ago now, that was the time that I stepped out of the client service side of us two. So in many ways, as us two starts to get bigger and bigger and more successful, I'm less to do with it. That's probably the reason. and the theme goes, your hair goes on with this. So then,
says the guy that then produces a 40 million plus download.
Well, that was, yeah, it was like, it was an element of luck. So I go on a journey where I, you know, Sinks is kind enough, and you know, our mindset is that we're going to make money with our clients, from our clients or from our partners, and we're going to use that money to take our risk on producing our own consumer facing, and they were actual apps in those days. And so we just go on this journey where I've year on year, I'm given a bigger and bigger team. I think eventually I have like 10 people that are at us to purely to work in my team, where we are just putting out a range of different experiments, really. And I think they start off really as just experiments, quite lightweight, novelty in many ways. But over time, you know, it's funny to lose money that you can afford to lose, you know, if you're producing things that you think is fun and should be in the world. But eventually you start to realize that it's not that fun to lose loads of money. And actually, if you stop making certain mistakes and build products the right way, then, you know, there's more chances of success. So eventually, I think, you know, about 6 years ago, I decided to actually want to make a game. Like, we made Whale Trail, and that was a chance, you know, rather than to be like a sort of interactive, well, it was interactive entertainment, but I wanted to actually make a game. If anything, to be able to tell people, like, I just make games. It was really difficult to explain what Us2 is, and it still is. In fact, I can't actually explain it. But, you know, if I could just say to most people, well, we make games, mobile games, kind of, you get it. But Whale Trail did well. Not financially. It costs a lot of money to make. But what it did do is it really helped cement our relationship with Apple. They had been supporting us through our releases for many years. And you know, seeing us as a studio that's not afraid to put our money where our mouth is. What I learned though is that, you know, you can make the jump there is that Whale Trail was a good game, was a good looking game, but mechanics wise, it wasn't brilliant. And that's because it was too weighted in sort of like visual designers and experienced designers as opposed to true game designers. And so what we suddenly realized was, is that we needed to hire actual people from the games world. I didn't want to like just build a games company that was like what I perceive was every other games company, like loads of sort of geeky guys in a basement or something. But I wanted to...
Basically us right now.
Well, that's what... Funny enough, I looked at you two then. I thought, where can I come up with the two geek guys? And we were in a basement. So we made another game called Blip Blup, which was, you know, I see it as a palate cleanser. It was a puzzle game, very minimal in design, but it was a chance for us to take some time out, just to sort of rid ourselves of the sort of madness and the hysteria of Whale Trail, because it was quite a crazy game. And in that time, we hired some incredible people. Dan, who now heads our games company, leads the whole company, and Ken Wong, who's now got his own company down in Australia. But those two coming on board, along with others, mixing in with the team we already had, I decided that, you know, I would give that team the space to just do something magical. So really, when you asked about what is the magic ingredients, it was belief in other people. It definitely wasn't about me. We committed, it was £1 million or $1 million. We knew we said it'd take as long as you need, but have some sort of understanding of commercials here.
Is that for Monument Valley?
That's for Monument Valley, yeah.
It cost you £1 million to make.
It cost $1 million. I think it was dollars. I think by the end, it's £1 million.
What is that in time?
That was a year. So it was eight people for over a year.
Okay.
So they are at that time in the tea building, sitting in the corner, or downstairs actually in our cyber cafe, as we call it. So they were kind of almost. It was almost like the funny thing there was they were in a corner where everyone eats in the day. But they're just sort of wedged in the corner. It's almost like to peer in like a zoo. But these are the guys and girls that are building Monument Valley. There were certain things I believed that we could do that would give us an opportunity to do something special. And not least, it was not going the freemium way. It was, let's make a premium game. Let's make it about experience. Let's make it, you know, I didn't like most of the games, mobile games that are out there. So let's make something that's more engaging. That is an experience that actually says something and touches people in a way that current game or mobile wasn't doing. And it's not about time wasting. It's not about filling someone's time with just because they're bored at a bus stop. It's actually about giving them a small amount of time to actually really appreciate something. Love it. So they started and they came up with three routes. And we, at that stage in the cyber cafe, we'd had this huge wall that anyone could just stick stuff up on. And it was, but primarily it was all the stuff the games team were doing. And Ken designed his one picture because he had a fascination with architecture. And it was of a little I don't even know if it was a princess, a little character sort of looking up at this bit of architecture. And it wasn't geometric. It wasn't abstract geometry then. It was just a building. And something about that, anyone from the studio just walked past, they liked it. And we did a big demo session. And that, when they had moved on, they started thinking it could have some sort of Escher-esque style impossible geometry. That was the one where people really, really got excited. So there was just a genuine feel that there was something, we were onto something here. And the success, though, was they all put down to the fact that it was made not in a games company, it was made in a user experience company. It was made in a company whereby we user test on people that didn't play games. So there's a lot of user testing. You know, it wasn't just like, let's just make some arbitrary thing which I'd done for 15 products before and not really care what people think, because this is the Mill Show. Well, the problem with the Mill Show is that no one likes the stuff that Mills puts out. So, but with this one, we had so many user sessions where we'd really listen to the feedback, and in terms of the length of the game, everything. So we really are confident by now. And then Steve eventually gets a bit of press in Wired the year before we release, or sort of 6 months leading up to it, where Wired say, wonderful, we couldn't have asked for better. Is this the most beautiful game of 2000 and whatever year it was, 14, 13, maybe, I can't remember. And I think because we had that bit of press, then we were able to use that to go to Apple and say, look, this is the hype that's starting. Other people got excited about it. You know, I was pretty prolific on Twitter by then, and we had a community. And I think just things were snowballing positively. And because timing plays a huge part in this, because there was so, I think there was a real sort of hope that that you could still make a premium game, it do still do well. And you didn't just have to make a freemium title and sort of, you know, essentially make a gambling, an addiction, be the reason it's successful.
So how much did it cost to download?
Well, we launched it, I think it was £4.99, so it's quite a lot of money, you know. Yeah.
So you don't have to be a genius to work out that that's probably the most profitable thing you've ever done?
Yeah, I wouldn't do £4.99 times 40 million, though. There are free downloads in that download as well. I think we're very open about the numbers. I think it's done £25-30 million. So, undoubtedly, that is the most successful thing. I mean, that has obviously wiped out the debt of 8 years of spending, yeah, you know, up to £1 million a year.
And given you, I guess, your own arsenal to launch new areas.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that, I think that's, so that's, you know, it's not just like you got all that money, you just spend it, not at all. You know, let's not forget, at this stage, it wasn't actually part of a group, but we've expanded. We are a group of companies now. We have our, you know, our agency side, we have our product building side, essentially. We have our games company, we have our investment side. Well, actually, they're all coupled into one side. But you're right, we use that money to support the studio's growth as well. You know, like if one of the studios wasn't doing well, then, you know, you've got to get money from somewhere. Now, obviously, you can go to, for us, it was a strategic move without knowing it was strategic, to find a revenue stream that wasn't beholden on us selling our time and materials to clients. So, you know, it's been both the best and worst thing that's happened to us, Monument Valley. We always say that. The best, because obviously it was finally, you know, I never cared about winning awards, but being up on that Apple stage, like getting a design award, winning the BAFTAs, making something where the team, where you just believed in people and they delivered, was just the best thing I've ever feeling. And the fact that it's a lovely story, and it changed, you know, it did help to change gaming. It became like a staple of gaming, which is brilliant. I didn't think I realised how much I wanted until we got it. The worst part of it was that it took our eye off the ball of our client service business, which was by then 300 people. And
I guess hard as well to keep people wanting to work for that part of the business when you've got the shiny thing over there.
Yeah, I think by then we had spent many years like dealing with that anyway. And I think people by then were mature enough and understood that, like, we're now a games business. It's not even in part of the team, when it's down in South London. And, you know, people that work there are purely focused on making games. And it's a very different business to making a banking app or making a new service. But what it did do is it allowed me and Sinks to probably spend 2 years not dealing with big issues in the businesses, because we had this money, we could just paper over the cracks. And that was damaging, because when we eventually realized that, you know, although we are one group, we are one us two, we actually want to have our businesses, they have to be standalone businesses. And when you remove, you know, that
pressure,
you put that pressure back onto each business, you actually get better businesses. But, you know, at the time, you know, it was dangerous. And then we also gave, you know, a fair amount of that money away to everyone. We had what we called a sharing platform, where we always said that if we ever deliver on one of our products that beyond our client service, we would equally distribute a percentage, I think it was 30% of the profit, to everybody. And that was something we did do, and we did again with Monovay too. But again, the problem with not being that business savvy, or certainly learning on the job, is that I don't think we ever making the money, we at the time we made it, we didn't really think about the fact that you need to reinvest into its own team as well. Like the games team has grown now, it's 28 people. You know, we're working on multiple titles now. That costs money, and we have to reinvest it. The studios needed some support. We put that in. We wanted to grow. So, but it's been, you know, like it's been a defining moment. I think nobody, if anyone knows of us two in the world, it will be because of Monument Valley. And I think that's the exciting thing going forward, is that to change that perception like that. We just want to use that as one of the things people know us like. And that's why I'm excited.
I mean, you touched on it, winning the Apple Design Award and everything else. So I saw a photo of you with Tim Cook at your office in London.
Yeah.
So what do you and the Apple CEO talk about?
A lot of talking about AR, actually. But you know what? So that was one of the most humbling experience I've ever had, and I was so lucky to spend, you know, the hour. I think we spent an hour with him. You know, obviously he runs the biggest company in the world, but yet he was, without a shadow of a doubt, there was something, an aura about him that made everyone that talked to him feel special. There was no arrogance with him at all. He calmed the room straight away. He spent time with everyone. He got really down with the mood boards. You know, he was there 3 weeks before we were announcing, and or was it a month before? I can't remember. Before we were announcing and releasing the game on their stage, and you know, he came to meet the people that are making great products. And it was the fact that he didn't just come in and go really quickly. He actually spent time there afterwards, just being part of it. And I think it was magical. I loved it.
Now I guess we've ticked off the basis. So build an incredible studio, make money, build a big company, internationalize, build your own consumer products. It's kind of like the wish list anyone could ever want. You've now moved into a more obvious space, which is venture, or as you call it, adventure.
Yep.
Talk to us about chapter seven.
So we made a decision to sort of split us two. Like, what is us two? We've always struggled to really understand what it is. You know, is it an agency? Is it a product builder? Is it an investment company? Is it a games company? Is it a foundation? You know, these are, you know, what the fuck is it? And so what we decided to do is we want the studios to be the best studios there are. We want, you know, we're proud of being one of the only privately owned client service businesses out there. And we want to make that, one of the best. I wouldn't say the biggest. I think we want to, whatever you need to do to be the best, we'll do. If that means bigger, we'll go bigger. And at the same time, we formed Adventure, which is a more focused view that I can spend my time on now and lead and drive Adventure. And Adventure is sort of made up of four pathways, which is kind of call them at the moment. We have our playground, which is a floor with about 80 people on in the T building, where it's kind of like a quasi co-working space / incubator / just place with great fucking people, like supporting one another. And we just enjoy, or I really enjoy, just being able to bring in people that align with our two values and learn from them and hopefully help them as well. And, you know, occasionally invest in them as well if that need. But the idea of having a community that's beyond the people we employ. We're trying to run our business the way that works best and with teams. So, like, you know, I proposed what I wanted to do with Adventure, and the board's job is to understand if it's feasibly possible financially. And these four paths are a journey for me, especially to try to get really excited again about building a new venture. So I want to build a new us to something eventually, whether it could be completely abstract, it could be us to ultra running, it could be another mindfulness product. But I don't know what it is yet, and I don't want it to be something I'm already doing. So I want to learn how to learn again. I don't feel like I've been learning. I've been so heads down. So I'm really excited about this sort of strategy of, like, within 3 years, I want to have built something new, or I want to have done, or I'm building it with somebody else who's going to build it.
We interrupt this episode to invite you to enjoy a moment of calm. I'm Tamara Levitt, the writer and narrator of the Meditations in the Calm app. Amidst the chaos and busyness of life, it's so important to pause. The calm and clarity we gain through meditation is an essential part of what makes a great leader. So take a moment now to close your eyes and bring your attention to your breath. Inhaling deeply and exhaling slowly. Feel your lungs expanding and contracting. And as you take this next breath, feel your whole body relax. And then, when you're ready, open your eyes. To learn more about the Calm app, visit calm.com/secretleaders for a 1-month trial. And now, back to today's guest.
So this next section is all about lessons and failures and, I guess, painting the next chapter in your life. So sponsored by Calm.com, which is Apple's 2017 app of the year and my personal choice for waking up every morning and starting my day. So let's kick off with the obvious. Take us through chapter 8 and talk about your journey with meditation.
What do you do to keep your mind active, other than the obvious? So are there some tactics you have? You mentioned mindfulness, but give us some tricks and tips from the world of Mills.
Running. I can't talk highly enough about it. And the more I learn about the benefits of running, the more it just brings me in balance. And I actually, prior to knowing that I would love running, one of our design directors years back, you know, could tell if I hadn't been on a run or done some exercise, because he would just say that I was just throwing like grenades. You know, there was just like not a piece about me. So running, I've actually just switched off from, I'm changing the way I use email and social. In fact, social at the moment, I'm kind of off it again at the moment. It's too easy to be sucked into it. And, you know, I wasn't achieving anything by being involved. So I haven't been using Twitter for quite a while now. But email, I think, was ruling my life. You know, I would be proud of being the best emailer in town. And I'd often tell people that. So now I'm trying, and this may well change by the time this even goes out. But, you know, I'm tempting. I look now at the email about 9 o'clock, and I look at it again about 2 o'clock, and that's it. The idea being that I'm present, and I haven't been present for many, many years. And it's actually, you know, it's weaning myself off an addiction, but it's really starting to help, because I think presence is the thing that is most lacking in many businesses. I saw so many people in our business, like in meetings with their laptops, checking out Slack.
You know, but I think this is a very difficult balance, because you talked earlier about being the guy, and I resonate with this, by the way.
I bet.
But being the guy who's always on and always available for people.
Yes.
And that comes with its limitations, and that comes with its, I mean, by its very definition, you can't be present on what you're doing if you're enabling other people to interrupt and disrupt your time and focus.
It's a really difficult, isn't it? Because I think you create this sort of persona that is you, and you think that people like you because of that, and you're right. But then you invariably end up disappointing them because you can't be on 24 hours a day. But you're right, it is difficult. I think I'm changing track, and sort of the tactic is now is to be better. Like, I'm going to spend less time with you, but it's going to be good time. And, you know, when you need me, I used to say, like, whenever you need me, 24/7, I'm there for you. And that's a lie, really, because I can't always be 24/7. So now I'm teaching myself to sort of say, you know, thanks for, you want something, but I'm going to have to get back to you when I've got time, because I was leading my life through others. You know, that's not a good place to be. But you burn out really badly, and I was so burnt out.
So we spend a lot of time listening to guests on how they handle stress, and that obviously in turn by its very nature will build resilience.
Yes.
What are your top tips on this?
Well, so I stopped drinking 6 months ago, and
I think that helps you manage stress.
For me, it's the greatest thing ever. You know, prior to stopping, you know, me and Sinks sort of congratulate ourselves on spending, you know, the last year every day, not, I wouldn't say drunk, but like, you know, drinking. And I just thought that was bad. Like, why was that a good thing? And, you know, it wasn't helping my sleep. It wasn't helping my diet. And I was like, how can I be sort of a proponent of better mental health if I'm not even looking after, I'm making the changes to look after myself. And I thought it would be hard, but actually I had this determination to be a better, you know, I wanted to be an ultra runner. I wanted to believe I can get myself to like a professional state, and it's going to be a hard slog, but I think I can do it. And I wanted to prove that I was actually better than the alcohol. So it's been the best thing I've ever done. You know, obviously over Christmas, I didn't drink either. I've got now, you're into that wonderful stage where I don't have to keep telling all my mates that I don't drink. You know, there's still a few of them that still sort of don't understand. But if you don't drink, it's just, you're in another world. So yeah, don't drink, sleep really bloody well. I have a routine now. I get up at 5:30 every morning. I am just stretching and I'm just spending time myself. Because I realised that stress that I was having was also not building myself the time to achieve the things I wanted to achieve. So, you know, when I actually wrote down, which I never usually do, the list of things I wanted to do stretching-wise and mindfulness-wise, it went to like an hour and a half. So then I understood why it was impossible for me to do it in the 5 minutes running around, when my kids were running around. So I've created this area upstairs, and it's just completely, it has given me like a better kick to the day. I also stopped drinking coffee, although now I'm back on it now, but on a much better balance with it.
When do you go running?
I go running every morning. So I'm in a lucky position, of course, that I own a company. And I thought, what's the point of owning a company if actually it was in charge of me? You know, the point of building us two all those years back was actually to be free in some ways.
Designing your own lifestyle.
Yeah, less about that, but it was always like, yeah, like no one could tell me what to do. But actually what happened is it got so bad, the company was winning. Like the company owned me in sinks. Like it was pretty hard. And, you know, questioned whether or not we still had it in us. And I understand actually why companies, people, founders sell. And I think more often it is because they hit that point. It's too stressful. It's like, what? I'm not getting anything out of it. So I thought, well, I don't want to leave and I don't want to sell it. So let's make it work better for me. So actually, if I know that if I go running for 1, 2 hours, 3 hours in the morning, and I usually super early, hence not drinking so I can get up earlier, it means that I can get in a better headspace.
Okay. Well, wrapping up, I'm going to go all the way to chapter 20 because I'm being generous about how long you're going to live with your health. What's it going to say on your epitaph?
I would hope that, you know, he did it his way. That's so fucking wank.
So you're Frank Sinatra?
Yeah, that's what I thought when I said it.
I feel like we should leave it there. That's done. Thank you very much for being an awesome guest.
Next week on Secret Leaders.
There's never a good time. So it is better to get out there than be perfect. And that's a problem for most people, because once you're out there, you feel it's a reflection on yourself. So of course you do not want to mess up. Just keep going. Look at your business like a child. Would you ever give up on it? No, you wouldn't. Are they going to scream all night, maybe for months on end? Yes, they are. Accept it.
That was a lovely, bubbly and funny Holly Tucker, a wildly energetic and passionate entrepreneur who built one of Britain's best-loved online marketplaces. Next week, you'll hear from the founder of NotOnTheHighStreet.com. She shares her impressive journey with us and talks about leaving the company she started and loved to begin a new chapter with Holly & Co. She's a huge supporter of young entrepreneurs starting up their journey, so if you want to hear how she could help you, well, you're just going to have to tune in or you'll miss out. See you then.
Don't miss an episode by subscribing to us on iTunes or Spotify. Just search for Secret Leaders. You can also check out our website at secretleaders.com for show notes and behind the scenes of each interview.
Hi, I'm Simon LaFosse, the founder of LaFosse Associates. We're a young, high-growth and co-owned business, and we're experts in attracting talent. If you want to build a great team or you just want advice, please get in touch. We run free seminars and we'd love to see you there. Thanks for your time.
This episode was hosted by Dan Murray, produced by me, Rich Martell, edited by Harry Morton at Lower Street Media, and if you're hearing this, that's probably thanks to Jennifer Osman, our marketing whiz from Canada.